Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 15th of March. We have lots of conversations this morning. There is a major report on Alzheimer's disease, which has just been released today, and it is titled Generation Alzheimer's, the Defining Disease of the Baby Boomers. These statistics will knock you out. Starting this year, more than 10,000 baby boomers a day will turn 65, and one in eight will develop Alzheimer's. We'll talk about what Alzheimer's is, how you distinguish it from dementia, how people are cared for when they have Alzheimer's, and if you have cared for somebody who has Alzheimer's, you know that it can go on for a long period of time. You don't have much support. You lose in so many ways the person you love. How do we deal with that in the healthcare community? So it's no longer for baby boomers a disease their grandparents and parents have had. It will be the baby boomers who will be facing this in huge numbers. We have two guests with us. We'll meet them momentarily a little bit later on today. We're going to have Senator Bernie Sanders with us. We just had a change in time for him. He did this historic filibuster. You know, he went on for 8 hours on December 10 on the Senate floor, very, very upset about the tax breaks given to the wealthy among us. He was upset with the president and with the Republican leadership. And so he talked about it. His filibuster is in a book, The Speech, A Historic Filibuster on Corporate Greed and the Decline of Our Middle Class. Bernie will be with us, and we'll have no problem at all talking, I'm sure. But we've switched times. He's got some kind of press conference, so he will be with us at 10:30 this morning. And we hope that the guest that we had scheduled to be with us at 10:30 can switch a half hour, and that is Asif Manvi. I'm sure that those of you who watch The Daily Show are very familiar with him. He is has been called the Islamic correspondent, the Mideast correspondent. He's quite a remarkable actor. He was born in India, lived in England, and had his college education and work life here in the United States. He's going to be heading the ACLU banquet in Milwaukee this weekend. I'll be emceeing that event, so it should be a good Saturday evening, and he will be with us. All morning for Alzheimer's, I know we will have many phone calls. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And we have two guests in studio. Dr. Richard London is with us. His specialty is geriatric medicine, and his interests are Alzheimer's, dementia, and geriatrics. He's with Wheaton Franciscan Medical Group here in the city of Milwaukee, and he's done some groundbreaking work in this whole area, which we'll talk about during the course of this hour. His philosophy is, I have a particular interest in the evaluation for concerns of too many medicines, loss of vigor, walking and balance problems, memory problems, undesired weight loss, and dementia, and he works closely with primary doctors. Dr. London, thank you very much for being with us.
Pleasure to be here.
Also joining us in our studios on this day that we're releasing a major report on Alzheimer's is Tom Lavacek. He is the executive director of the Alzheimer's Association Southeastern Wisconsin chapter, and he oversees programs, fundraising, fiscal operations in the chapter's 11-county region. He also directed the Milwaukee Office of Disability Rights Wisconsin, the statewide protection and advocacy system for people with disabilities, and he was also director of the advocacy and independent living programs at United Cerebral Palsy of Southeastern Wisconsin. In 1999, he received a Joseph P. Kennedy Jr. Foundation Public Policy Fellowship and served in Washington for a year as a disability fellow in the office of U.S. Senator Tom Harkin. And welcome to you. Thank you very much, both of you, for being with us.
Thanks.
Let's start with some of these numbers that are in the report. We do think of this as our parents' or grandparents' disease. Mm-hmm. I'm a baby boomer. You're both baby boomers. It's going to be our disease in a huge way and pretty darn soon.
Yeah, and in many ways it already is because of the caregiving burden that many of us are facing. But it's coming directly at us. As you mentioned, 78 million baby boomers. Somewhere around 10,000 a day, turning 65 this year. That's the front edge of it. And if we don't do anything dramatically different about the trajectory of Alzheimer's disease, you're right, about 10 million of those individuals, one out of eight of them, will have Alzheimer's disease unless something changes in terms of the treatment which, you know, the Alzheimer's Association is working on all the time. And there's some reason to hope out there, you know,
good,
in terms of things that are things that are coming down the line. You know, what the big hope is really that we turn Alzheimer's disease in from what it is right now, which is really it's a death sentence. I mean, it's an untreatable condition, and we move it into a manageable condition, kind of in the same way that heart disease became back in the 80s, where you could get a test for heart disease problems before you were even symptomatic, before you had that first heart attack. And then you could do things. You could take a statin and you could pick up your exercise and watch your diet and nutrition, and you could actually dramatically reduce your risks of ever having that first heart attack.
I want to pipe in here for a minute because I think it's a treatable condition right now, but the treatments just aren't as good as we'd like.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly there are things we can do, and I think that that the interventions can be very helpful for people.
Well, I looked at the statistics of the amount of money we spend on cancer, on mm-hmm. heart disease, which you just mentioned, and look at how many people are affected by Alzheimer's, mm-hmm. and that money that we spend federally is way down on the list. And I was wondering, considering it affects so many people and will more because we're living longer, what's going on?
Yeah, those numbers are interesting. You know, and once again, at the Alzheimer's Association, our number one federal priority is to basically quadruple the amount of money that's mm-hmm. going into Alzheimer's research. Right now, it's about $475 million a year through the National Institutes of Health. We want it to be at least $2 billion. Compare that to cancer, which is at about $8 billion a year. And not to say anything bad about cancer funding for research. Obviously, cancer is horrible. Same thing with heart disease. But the point that we try to make in terms of our request for more federal funding for Alzheimer's research is that research works. If you look at the death rates for cancer and heart disease and AIDS and other conditions like that, they're actually going down across the country. Alzheimer's is going up dramatically. It's the fifth leading cause of death now in
wow.
people 65 years and older.
Dr. London, please explain, because I think we're still confused about what it is. And in the chances of getting Alzheimer's when you're very old are greater than when you're not as old or you're starting to be old. Can you explain the differences between dementia and Alzheimer's? And does dementia become Alzheimer's?
Sure. So dementia means that your brain isn't functioning the way it used to. So you've had a loss of brain function, and it's severe enough to interfere with your ability to do things.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, typically people that have dementia have more trouble balancing their checkbook, throwing a dinner party for their friends, organizing that and carrying it out, or remembering their medicines or their appointments with their doctors. If your brain didn't work well to begin with, and it still doesn't work well, that's not dementia. So if you were never good at math and you're still not good at math, that's not dementia. But if you were pretty good and now you can't do arithmetic, that may be a sign of dementia. So dementia is the general term, and there's lots of different causes of dementia. Alzheimer's disease is by far the most common cause of dementia. It's 2/3 to 3/4 of the people that have dementia have Alzheimer's disease. But there are other causes, and that's one of the reasons that it's important to actually have a formal diagnosis to figure out what's going on. One of the things that we want to find out is, well, is there something reversible that's causing this brain dysfunction?
Mm-hmm.
Alzheimer's disease is not reversible. As I said, it's treatable. But there are some reversible causes of dementia, such as thyroid problems, vitamin deficiencies, and probably the most common is medications that are interfering with your brain function.
Mm.
And so carefully looking at all those things and figuring out how to help people and how to find things that that may actually reverse some of the brain dysfunction is very important.
Mm-hmm. And once you are diagnosed, you say that it's treatable. How is it treatable? Are there medications now on the market that will slow it down, or is it inevitable that you will die from this and you will die, unless we intervene rapidly, a pretty horrific death?
So Alzheimer's disease is mostly a disease of older age. So it can occur in younger people, and I certainly see it in younger people, but it's rare in people under 60. It's much more common in people in their 70s and 80s and beyond. And the treatment is a number of things. When we talk about medicines, I think the first thing is to find is to look and see if there's medicines that are making it worse and take those medicines away. Because some of the really common medicines that older people take can cause this. One example is over-the-counter sleeping pills.
Really?
That have something called diphenhydramine in them can interfere with brain function. People that are taking strong pain medicines, muscle relaxants, or drugs for nervousness, anxiety, like Valium and Librium, for example, can interfere with brain function. And taking those things away can really improve a person's ability to think clearly.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are medicines that help. They're not as good as we'd like them to be, but there are several medicines on the market. And they seem to slow down the process. Most people that take them don't report that they feel better. And their families sometimes notice that things are a little bit better. But the research has shown that on the average, it allows people to stay independent at least 6 to 12 months longer than if they didn't take the medicine. And that may not sound like a lot of time, but if you think if that could keep you out of a nursing home for a year, most people would want to do that.
Right. But the number of people who are in nursing homes who have Alzheimer's is quite high, isn't it, Tom?
Yeah, it eventually becomes about 40% of all nursing home residents with dementia. And most caregivers will eventually move towards some form of long-term care placement. Although the fact of the matter is, Kathleen, that about 80% of the people with Alzheimer's are living in the community, in family homes. And a ton of care is obviously provided by informal family caregivers. The other thing I would just tack on to what Rick was saying about treatments is that the drugs that are out there right now, the five, if you can remove those other confounding factors that Rick was talking about, you know, infections and complications from other drugs, the drugs that we have right now really work on the symptom. Basically, without slowing the overall progression of the disease. That we haven't found anything yet that works on the brain mechanism that's safe and effective to use over time. That being said, there's over 75 medications right now that are in testing around the world that would actually work on the disease process itself, that are hoped to work on the disease process itself. And, you know, that's where the big hope for the future is to come up with something that slows that curve. You know, from the point of diagnosis to the point of death, it's a pretty steady progression. And if you can slow that curve dramatically for like 3 to 5 years and push the worst part of the disease out there into the future, that's sort of the holy grail. That's what we're all hoping for.
Mm-hmm. The stories we hear, and I'm wondering if these are common, of people who care for loved ones with Alzheimer's, is that they forget everything. They forget who they're talking to. They forget who they are. They just forget all of the daily aspects of life, turning off the stove, turning on the stove, everything, which must be. And I'm wondering, A, if that's the most severe cases of Alzheimer's. Does that happen to most people who have Alzheimer's? And B, what this does for caregivers, which we can talk about.
So it's a disease that changes over time. And it's particularly hard to deal with because it changes. It's unlike somebody that has a disability. They have trouble walking, and they always have trouble walking, and you learn how to deal with that. But this is something that every few months there's something new because of progressive loss of brain function. The earliest thing is almost always forgetfulness. And we tend to cut old people a lot of slack with this. Although we all know people that live into their 90s whose brain is absolutely sharp and they remember everything they're supposed to do today and have no problems with forgetfulness, a lot of family members just accept the fact that older people just are forgetful and they don't recognize that it's a disease until it gets really severe. And when it gets really severe, People don't recognize family members. They forget how to do things. They forget how to eat. Mm. And eventually will lose weight and, really have the end of this disease is not pleasant.
No, I'm sure it's not. Yeah. And forgetfulness, when you say that, is a little bit of forgetfulness a natural part of growing older?
Yeah, sure. The research on that is that the peak age of memory is actually 28 years old.
Is it really?
If you're wondering.
It's all downhill.
Yeah. And then there's a ton of research into normal aging along with research into Alzheimer's-related aging. And in the field of normal aging, there's research that indicates that the normal memory loss in an adult between the ages of 28 and 60 is about 17% of your peak memory.
Oh my!
So there's a certain amount of memory loss that is expected or normal. But then there's the severity of it, and then there's the type of it, I think we would say, that is very dramatically different. The catchphrase that we use at the Alzheimer's Association to talk about this is normal aging might be forgetting your keys, getting down to the car and realizing you forgot your keys. Alzheimer's related memory loss is forgetting what a key is for. You look at it and you don't know what it is. Familiar objects that you forget what their uses are. And many other things that you would forget, like how to button a shirt, things that you wouldn't think of as normal forgetfulness.
Mm-hmm. Although those things are things that we see in later stages. So in the earliest stage, people usually know exactly what to do with the key and how to start up the car, and which can be a problem.
Yeah.
Right.
So, the problem is that there is a fine line between what's normal and what is a disease. And that's one of the reasons that we have so much trouble detecting people with this problem early on.
How do you detect it? Do you do a blood test or how do you diagnose this?
So this is what we call a clinical diagnosis. And that means we talk to people. We ask them questions and we watch them walk. And do a physical examination. There really is no blood test or X-ray or MRI that is helpful to confirm the diagnosis. The tests that we do actually are to see if there's something else that's contributing to it or causing it. For example, if we do an MRI, we're really looking to see if there's a brain tumor that might be causing this. Blood tests are done to see if there's thyroid problems or vitamin deficiencies or kidney disease or other things that could be adding to memory loss. But the diagnosis is using standardized questions to see how a person is processing information.
Yeah. When you talk about those 75 medications that are in testing right now and said that there are five medications on the market right now that may slow the progress of the disease, did I hear you right?
They work on the symptom. You know, if there's an underlying disease process that's going on in the brain, not to pitch our association too much, but on our website, ALZ.org, there is a fascinating tool called Tour of the Brain, which is an interactive process that a person can go through and kind of understand a little bit about how the brain works and then how Alzheimer's works in the brain and how it'll typically start to attack and destroy brain cells in the hippocampal area of the brain, which is where the memory center is, and move out from there to other regions of the brain. And as it moves out, that's where the progression of the disease happens. And fairly dramatic slides that are from autopsies of normal brains at the point of death of a 90-year-old and an Alzheimer's brain, which just shows this severe shrinkage and deterioration throughout the brain. So that disease process that's happening where cell death, neuronal death is happening throughout the brain, we don't have a medication yet that stops that. Mm. And that's at some point, if you're ever going to talk about a cure or something that would be a true disease-modifying process. That's the kind of drug that we're looking for that we haven't found yet.
And it may be that we'll have to start treatment before people have any symptoms
exactly.
at all.
Oh, really?
This is a disease that probably goes on for 10 or 20 years before people have symptoms.
So that's the intersection that we're at the association and scientists all over the world would love to see, where you can detect it in the brain of someone before they're showing any symptoms, okay? And then have a new therapy, a new treatment that you can get to that person before they're before they even start to show symptoms that would push it off. That's when you begin to talk about a manageable condition in a different way than we have right now.
Do you think that maybe we've just pushed the age limit too much? Do you think that we're just living too long?
Well, based on my age now, I'm feeling like... the answer is no. I think what all of us would like is to live to old age and to function at a high level for our brains to work well and our bodies to work well as long as possible. And I think that's a reasonable goal for a lot of people, that there are things that can help with this and to keep people as productive members of society, still functioning at a very high level.
One final question for me, and we'll go to phone calls. We keep hearing, and because so many people get this, or we're caring for people who get this, that everybody's pretty worried about it. So there are, as you know, all these magazine articles. People are saying, take this to eat. Your brain is a muscle. You got to do crossword puzzles. You got to exercise to keep your brain going. It's going to, do wonders for you and ward against Alzheimer's. Is there any truth to exercising this muscle in some way, and if so, what that way might be?
So, I think that's good advice. I would say the research is not real strong on prevention, but there is evidence that if you can keep your cardiovascular system healthy, that it actually helps prevent Alzheimer's disease.
Oh.
Yeah.
So the same advice that we give to people to prevent heart disease seems to decrease your risk of Alzheimer's disease. So eat the Mediterranean diet. It's not any one food, but it's less saturated fat, less fat from animals, and more of the liquid oils, olive oil, and things like that. But it's not a diet of only olive oil. It's having a well-balanced diet with lots of fruits and vegetables and whole grains.
But exercise is critically important. And
physical
more
exercise.
More physical exercise. More and more research coming out about this all the time, including one just from this last month that actually demonstrated or actually proved an earlier study of hippocampal growth. In other words, aerobic exercise in 60-year-olds and older over a prolonged period of time actually grew new brain cells. Okay, so what we're learning more and more at the Alzheimer's Association is that exercise is probably the number one preventative thing you can do. It's controlling those cardiovascular risk factors that Rick was talking about. It promotes a greater flow of blood and oxygen to the brain. It appears to actually have the potential to grow new brain cells to counteract the neuronal death that is happening. In the absence of exercise and decent diet, you can do all the crossword puzzles you want, it's not going to make that much difference.
And let me ask both of you, it's radio and people can't see you, but these guys are both, they're baby boomers and they're incredibly fit and happy and obviously haven't lost their
brains. Well, thank you.
So what do? Do you guys run or swim, or you must do something being in this field?
I enjoy exercise and I cross-country ski and run and cycle.
Aerobics at the gym in the winter, and then being out in however way I can, kayaking, walking through the woods, whatever.
There you go.
But aerobics is huge.
All right. Let's welcome phone calls. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. We're talking about Alzheimer's today. The release of a major report by the Alzheimer's Association, Generation Alzheimer's, the defining disease of the baby boomers. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. 8655. Feel free to send us an email if you would like to do that. That address is talk@WPR.org. Talk@WPR.org. Our guests are Dr. Richard London. His specialty is geriatric medicine. He is with the Wheaton Franciscan Medical Group, and he is board certified in family practice and also geriatric medicine. Tom Lavacek is also with us. He's the executive director of the Alzheimer's Association Southeastern Southeastern Wisconsin chapter. Our lines are all filled. We'll start taking your phone calls in a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour number two of our program, Senator Bernie Sanders is going to join us. His filibuster is included along with some other thoughts in a new paperback, The Speech, a historic filibuster on corporate greed and the decline of our middle class. Also joining us, and he'll be the headline speaker at the ACLU of Wisconsin meeting, annual meeting. It's a big to-do at the Pfister Hotel here in Milwaukee. I'll be emceeing that event. It should be fun. He is an award-winning playwright, author, and actor. He's also, you probably know him as being correspondent for Comedy Central's The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. So that's our number two. Let's go to phone calls. We have many of them. Suzanne in Madison is our first caller. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I have a sister who's got early onset Alzheimer's. She's under 60 years old and seems to be progressing pretty fast. And she's quite anxious. And I'm curious if you think treatments or behavior modifications to control anxiety, nervousness, to increase focus, such as, I don't know, meditation, if that's a factor that is, that can slow down the progression.
How old is she, Suzanne?
She's under 60, mm-hmm. 58.
Okay.
And also wondering about what you've heard about, saffron. Saffron as a as an element or whatever you would call it to slow the progression.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Dr. London?
So, Suzanne, early onset Alzheimer's disease in people under 60 is pretty rare and certainly a horrible condition. The behavioral problems that occur, like anxiety, are often difficult to manage, and there's no simple answer to this. Some people respond to one thing but not to another. One bit of advice is that people around the person with the problem can change their approach to them to help them to feel more comfortable, to help the person with the disease to feel more comfortable. And this is sometimes trial and error. To learn how to talk to people, how to change things in the environment. Some things that have been helpful for people, for example, are using lavender oil.
Really?
Has been soothing to some people that are feeling anxious. Other things that can be helpful are to stick to a certain routine so that the day is structured exactly the same every day, so that people don't have the anxiety of not understanding what's happening. There are behavioral specialists that can help with some ideas about this. The Alzheimer Association on their website has some ideas about how to help with this. And the Alzheimer Association also has a 24/7 helpline that you can call into to get some advice.
Mm. And let's spend some time talking about those caregivers. Tom, let's go to you on this, because I've known people, we all have, who have cared for loved ones with Alzheimer's, and it's got to be the most draining kind of caregiving imaginable, going on for years and years when the person you marry doesn't even know who you are, and you don't have anybody who can comfort you during all of this. I don't know how people deal with this. I call them saints, and maybe I'll have to do this at some point in my life, and I can be a saint as well. But it's a hard, hard go, isn't it?
It can be a very challenging experience for many caregivers. From the point of diagnosis until death in the United States right now, you're talking about 7 or 8 years on average. And for some people, it's much longer than that. At the Alzheimer's Association, we work with some families over a period of 12 to 20 years.
Oh, my gosh. And it,
you know, one of the things that, that Rick just touched on that is so critical is to become a skillful caregiver, to spend a little time on it. Because one of the things that you can actually do to shape the course and the trajectory of the disease in your family is to become a more savvy caregiver, as we call it at the Alzheimer's Association. There's certain parts of it that you have to kind of learn how to let go of certain things, expectations and things. There's roles that change in marriages and in families because of Alzheimer's disease. But the thing that we like to remind people of is that there's many people that have walked that path. And many times what we see that the strongest form of support is from caregiver to caregiver. And so we actually spend a lot of our time organizing support groups and helping people connect up with each other. And there's many more ways of doing that these days in the online world. And so many people are finding support through online support groups, which are very helpful in blogs and things like that. And so getting back to the caller's concerns, absolutely, if things like meditation are helpful, they're helpful. If things like saffron make a difference, one of the things that was found in the Mediterranean diet studies was curcumin or curry as being something that appears to have a therapeutic benefit. However, you know, once again, there's never been a food substance that's been documented in research to actually change the course of the disease. There are some things that seem to be helpful, and there are some things that seem to be harmful. For example, excessive use of alcohol can be a problem, and people who are anxious may drink too much too, which isn't going to help the situation. But since Rick mentioned the helpline, I just want to put that out there for the callers. Mm-hmm. It's 1-800-272-3900.
Give that again, please.
1-800-272-3900, and that is 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year.
All right. Thank you very much. And when you mentioned some of the meditation, et cetera, you can also say that Suzanne might benefit from some of that as well, the
caregiver.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Jeff in Green Bay. Hi.
Hi. My question is about the genetics of the disease. I've got a grandfather that had the disease and so experienced it firsthand. And just wondering, you know, then specifics in terms of if it's your mom's side or dad's side, if there's anything specific on that. And just what are the chances of getting it as it flows through the generations?
Dr. Lund.
Jeff, if you have a close relative, parent or a brother and sister with the disease, then your risk is about double compared to somebody that doesn't have a close relative. The earlier the person has the problem, the earlier in their life that they developed Alzheimer's disease, the greater the risk to family members. One of the interesting things about Alzheimer's disease is we didn't used to diagnose this hardly at all until the last 20 years. So a lot of our grandparents may have had it, and we called it senility or just getting older. And so it makes it hard to know in some cases if your parent or grandparent actually had it. But certainly if they had some senility, then they probably did have it. So there is an increased risk. On the other hand, there are people that develop Alzheimer's disease that have nobody in the family that ever had it. So the advice is, regardless of whether you have a family member or not, we should all be doing things to keep our brains healthy and watching our blood pressure, keeping our cholesterol good, eating well, and exercising.
Mm-hmm. Tom?
Yeah. What we talk about when we talk about heredity or genetic risk factors is we call them susceptibility risk factors. It's not a guarantee. If you have Alzheimer's, as Rick said, close in your family, on both sides of your family, going back for generations, your susceptibility is higher. But it's not a guarantee. It will skip generations. It will miss people. And as Rick said, it's very mysterious. Some people will develop it that didn't have the family history that we know of. But the other risk factors are things that are controllable, and that's the key. The cardiovascular risk factors are things that you can do something about. Alzheimer's disease is very closely associated with diabetes also.
Oh, is it really?
And controlling your numbers is what we always say. Your diabetes, your cholesterol levels, and your weight, because there is quite a bit of evidence that obesity is a risk factor for both cardiovascular disease, of course, and for Alzheimer's.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Jeff, for the call. Here's an email that's come in, and it will bring us more into the area of funding and for this. Do you think that there's an element of ageism in regarding to funding for research? By that, I mean a perception by the general population that it only affects old people and it's just a part of aging, whereas cancer strikes all ages.
Well, it could be ageism, and it could just be that Rick just indicated that up until recently, we thought of it as normal aging. We didn't think of it as a disease. Alzheimer's disease is a disease, okay? And whether you think people, you know, I will leave the question of whether we're living too long or whether we're pushing the boundary to ethicists and to other people. What we at the association are concerned about is that this is a disease, and it's not normal aging, and we want to do something about this disease. So from that point of view, whether it's ageism or whether it's just finally coming around to the science and realizing that this is a disease and a condition that should be treated, we don't care. We just want to see the trajectory change on that. The overall funding for Alzheimer's research is pathetically low compared
to other conditions. Well, let's bring money into this because, you know, we've done 50 million shows on the budget and we've been through what we've been through in Wisconsin and we'll be on this issue more. And we've got Bernie Sanders coming up next hour. So let's talk about where we place our money. And there's a reason that we're not funding Alzheimer's research the way we should. I'm wondering, when you look at the federal budget, where money is allocated for research on this disease, if state money has been cut for this, and why that may be the case, and how we determine as a society that we need to fund this. Because it's going to affect us, you know, just right. For self-serving purposes.
Absolutely. Well, yeah. I mean, if you look at just the pure numbers, Alzheimer's disease research right now in the federal budget is about $470 million a year, which
sounds very low.
Well, you know, some people think it's low. Some people think it's high. We compare it to things like cancer research, which is about $8 billion a year, heart disease research, which is about $6 billion a year. And not to take anything away from those conditions, what we like to point out is that research works. Death rates for cardiovascular disease, death rates for cancer are going down. There are now many people who proudly wear the ribbon and say, I am a survivor of cancer. There's no survivors yet of Alzheimer's. And that is why we want to increase that funding for Alzheimer's research. There are a number of – in the NIH – there's a strong, tough vetting process for proposals that come in. And there's many proposals that get ranked at the very top level. And out of that very top level, NIH right now is funding about 10% of those proposals. So there's 90% of the top proposals that we could be funding that we're not.
Let's go next to Pat. Hi, Pat.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
And thank you for this great show.
You're welcome.
My dad is 96 years old.
Oh, God bless him.
A nursing home. He has advanced Alzheimer's. And I feed him breakfast every day. I'm close enough to do that. And I've been doing that for over 3 years. So I've gotten to know the people in the memory care unit. And I guess I'd like to get a different slant on this. I see them as joyful, peaceful. And I think it's the families who probably have the most problems with this. My dad doesn't talk too much, so I consider him a good listener. I tell him what the weather's like. He doesn't recognize me as his daughter, but he recognizes me as a person who comes and feeds him breakfast, so he thinks I'm a really nice person. And I always say I had such a rotten childhood that I'm so glad he forgot all that. But I also do activities with Alzheimer's people, arts and crafts, and just because I wanted to, and with other residents, and I play my accordion for them. So there's so much positive there, and I'm sure it has to do with the good care they receive. But it isn't all doom and gloom, but I think we have to approach them as the different people that they've become. About once a year, my dad will actually look in my eyes. He's taken my hand, kissed it, and say, "I really love you." Mm. So I think there's still sparks there of some recognition and some relationship. But the other thing, which I did not mention to the woman when I called in, is that I have actually worked with people who are dealing with friends and relatives who have early onset Alzheimer's. And I do so many activities up at the nursing home that I've actually come out with two small booklets and things that you can do with the elderly. And I've done these with the elderly. I do an activity group every week. So I know these work. And I've done some of these with Alzheimer's, even with advanced Alzheimer's. So it's just finding things that we can do with them and looking at the bright side of this, even though there aren't very many bright sides. Mm-hmm.
Yes, the person is still in there somewhere. And I think you've done a great job of recognizing that. And it sounds like your father is getting excellent care, that being in a setting where he is comfortable and seems to enjoy his life is exactly what we would want for people with that stage of the disease.
Yeah.
Oh, and, she sounds and wonderful.
Part of the reason, I'm going to guess, why he receives wonderful care is because she's there feeding him breakfast every morning. Now, not every caregiver can do that, but we strongly recommend that caregivers are in the facilities a lot, and that makes a big difference. But I would like to just chime in on what she said, because this is a wonderful aspect that is sometimes lost in the debate. Along with many of the other things that people forget throughout the process of Alzheimer's, there can be some good things that people forget. For example, old grudges and old things that they may be held for their whole lives. There's oftentimes in people the ability to open up new creative avenues. We have a program called Memories in the Making, which goes into facilities and does watercolor art with residents. And some of the works of art that get produced are actually very stunning. And one of the things that the person forgot is that they never thought they could be an artist. and so, you know, capitalizing on every aspect of this as you move forward and becoming a successful caregiver, as Pat obviously has become, is really key.
And what about the quality of care? If you have this disease for a long time and you're advanced and you're in a nursing home for 8 or 9 years, there are some people among us who can afford really top-notch care. And I've seen nursing home facilities. I've dealt with them. Some of them are good and some of them are really bad.
Yeah, we've got them all over the map. And,
right.
And Rick has really been helping us over the course of the last year. We have a challenging behaviors task force that's gone on at the chapter level. Some of the facilities are much better equipped. Right now in Wisconsin, we actually don't have any standards in state law that describe what dementia care is. And so it's relatively easy to get licensed to provide dementia care. And we feel that there are some people out there that are providing it that could use a lot of upgrading in terms of the skills and talents of their staff and the kinds of things that they provide to their residents. And then not surprisingly, we have problems with many facilities when the person enters into the later stages of the disease and may exhibit challenging behaviors that they try to get them out of the facility. And they wind up in some awful situations at the Milwaukee County Mental Health Complex and with police and things like that, many of which we believe are preventable. And the task force and with Rick's participation, we've been trying to emphasize some of the things that facilities can do.
Mm-hmm. Let's pause for just a moment and get an answer to that. What can they do? And take more phone calls. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders will be with us to talk about the historic filibuster that he gave on December 10 before the Senate. We'll also be speaking with Asif Mandi, who is a correspondent for Comedy Central's The Daily Show. He's going to be keynote speaker at the ACLU of Wisconsin's banquet this coming Saturday. What is it that facilities can do?
Well, it really makes a big difference how caregivers, and in this case, perhaps the caregivers in a facility, approach the person with the problem. And I think you can learn these skills. Some people just have them naturally, and some people have a lot of trouble learning them. But it's how you look. People sometimes don't understand the words anymore, but they understand the expression on your face. And if you look like somebody who's going to help rather than somebody who's going to hurt them, how you touch them, holding their hand. So that's the first thing. The other thing is that people who have dementia or Alzheimer's disease are at risk of developing other problems where their brain suddenly gets worse. We call this delirium, where they can have an abrupt change in their behavior if they get sick in some other way or if they get a medicine that has some bad effects on their behavior. So being sensitive to those things, the common example is somebody gets pneumonia, and the first sign of the pneumonia is that somebody isn't acting right, that they're calling out, or they seem to be distressed, or they're behaving differently. This can also happen with a heart attack or a stroke, where people are actually just behaving differently, because with Alzheimer's disease, they can't tell you what's wrong. People who are constipated, for instance, could have changes in their behavior. So really being sensitive to the behavior as communication, that if there's a change in behavior, that person may be trying to tell you something.
But am I getting this wrong? If you have compassion on your face, if you're holding somebody's hand, if you have that person's best interests at heart, are you saying that it can change the way that Alzheimer's manifests itself? Because we also hear that people can lash out at you for no good reason. Anger comes from nowhere. It's just out of control. If you're a good person in your caregiving, that may not happen, or it won't happen as frequently?
Well, I think it probably doesn't happen as often. Okay. I think it can modulate, it can modify those behaviors to some extent. And as Tom was saying, with a skilled caregiver, you learn what topics not to discuss or what not to do.
Judy in Madison, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. Calling about my father, who will be 92 at the end of the month, has quite severe hearing loss, which seems to isolate him a great deal. He used to be very social. He still is social, but has a hard time hearing people. And I'm wondering what the if hearing loss and that isolation can bring on Alzheimer's, or what its effect with Alzheimer's is.
So problems with hearing wouldn't by themselves bring on Alzheimer's disease, but it would make it more difficult to detect if people aren't hearing well. When we examine people in our offices for Alzheimer's disease, we have portable amplifiers that we use to make sure that people are hearing us and that the problem isn't processing the information, but the problem is that it's not getting into their brain because they're not hearing well, and certainly doing things to try to improve people's hearing. There's actually some inexpensive portable devices that we use that look like the old Sony Walkman. They're about that size, and they can help with one-to-one conversations or seeing a hearing specialist would be important.
Yeah, and sometimes harder to talk those older gentlemen into believing that there is a hearing loss.
exactly.
But yeah, and one of the things though that Judy mentioned was isolation, and in especially people living in the community, One of the things that is a co-occurring disorder that we are very concerned about is depression, and it's often connected with social isolation. And so isolation, as individuals begin to isolate themselves more and more, that is a cause for concern for the caregiver. Whether it's Alzheimer's or treatable depression, it should be looked at.
Yeah,
and we think that social being in social settings actually helps people's brains to function well.
Exactly.
Give us, if you would please, we have about 40 seconds left, and I want to make sure that we have places to go for more information,
right.
Books to read maybe.
Sure, yeah. Call the Alzheimer's Association. That number, the 800 number is 1-800-272-3900. We're located in Milwaukee at 620 South 76th Street. We have a complete lending library resource library of all the most popular books, 36 Hour Day, and all the books of people, Still Alice and others that you may have talked about on your show. People really appreciate coming in and getting those and a number of resources, and we can provide one-on-one care consultations and assistance to families with any questions that you have about Alzheimer's.
Okay. The other area we never got into, just quickly, do people need to pay more attention to sports and early onset of Alzheimer's? Football, soccer, a lot of sports. Are we just beginning to learn about that?
Well, certainly there's more evidence that injuring your head and having concussions isn't good for your brain.
Yeah.
So wear helmets, avoid sports where you're likely to get knocked out.
Okay. Thank you both very much. Such an informative hour. Our thanks to Dr. Richard London. He is a geriatric medicine doctor and primary care doctor, and Tom Lavacek, who is executive director of the Alzheimer's Association. Thanks for all of your calls. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for putting together such an interesting and informative hour. News coming up from National Public Radio, and we will return with more conversation.